I don't know what you were doing last Thursday, but on Thanksgiving, I was one of 21 people sitting around a couple of tables at my parents' house in Mendocino. That was actually a small gathering for us. One of my sisters and her family spent the holiday with my brother-in-law's people, and it was a rare year in that there were no family friends at the table, at least not in person. The truth is that at Thanksgiving at my childhood home, there are always a lot of other people present in spirit and in memory. Because as we cook and catch up and spend time together around the table or just in the home, we tell a lot of stories. And to be honest, a lot of it is just gossip. But quite a bit of the storytelling involves the kind of stories that form us as a people. The stories may be true or they may be refracted through the lens of a faulty memory. Some of the stories get better with age. Others are purely the product of our God-given imaginations. Either way, the stories are a gift. Not only do they teach us lessons and entertain us, but they remind us that the circle of our affection is always bigger than the table that has been set. For when a story has been told well, even the dead can be raised, at least for a moment. At least in our hearts. This Thanksgiving, we talked a bit about a man named Bill. Bill was part of the village that raised me and my siblings, and he now sings in the great celestial choir. In those days, my stepfather was a building contractor, and Bill was always on my dad's crew. When there were 10 guys working, Bill was the foreman. When it was just Bill and my dad, Bill was the partner. Either way, Bill was a constant. Bill was born in Arkansas and came to California's North Coast during the Depression to work as a logger, which he did for many years until a poorly felled redwood tree landed on him and dragged him down a hill. Bill broke his back on that day and he spent a long time recovering. Once he was reasonably ambulatory, Bill knew he'd never go back to work in the woods, but he was bored out of his mind. His son happened to be the realtor who sold my parents the property on which our house was built, and through that relationship, Bill started working for my dad. Bill was something of a Renaissance man. Bill could build a perfect chicken coop from memory, and he could sing old Southern hymns reading shape notes. There was hardly a tool that Bill couldn't use, and not very many tools that Bill didn't have. He always had Ritz crackers to share, and he was good about listening to me tell him about what I was learning in Sunday school, though he seldom darkened the doorway of a church himself. At Thanksgiving, I heard the story of why Bill stopped hunting. At the time, Bill and a friend were logging a stand of redwoods in the hills above Elk, which is down the coast a ways. Driving to work early one summer morning as Bill and his friend made their way south from Mendocino past Albion and just over the Salmon Creek Bridge, they saw a bunny run across the road in front of them. It was unexpected and kind of cute, and Bill said to his friend, "Damn, I wish I had my .22. I'd go shoot that rabbit." And the friend looked at Bill and said, "Do you mean to say that you don't want to come back this way tomorrow and see that bunny again?" Bill never hunted again after that. He still believed in hunting. Every year he'd get his deer tags and he'd give them to his grandson, Randy. No doubt he understood hunting to be a perfectly respectable way to put food on the table, especially during lean years, such as Bill certainly would have known in Arkansas during the Depression. But still, something in that encounter with the bunny and in the logging partner's response to it convicted Bill. He realized his desire was not to hunt, but to kill. And there's a difference. And Bill did not want to be a killer. I suppose that was the moment when somewhere in Bill's soul, the master blacksmith hammered a sword into a plowshare. Today is the first Sunday of Advent, and it is traditional on the first Sunday of Advent to talk about eschatology, which is a fancy seminary-trained word that refers to the fullness of time, the end of days, the second coming of Christ. This focus on final things is meant to remind us that just as folks waited for the first coming of the Messiah, the Christ, we still wait for some rough beast, its hour come round at last, to slouch towards Bethlehem to be born. For a lot of Christians, this wait is a literal one. They expect Jesus to come on clouds descending, to separate the sheep from the goats, to sound the final trump, to cause the stars to fall from the sky, and to kick ass. But even those of us who don't necessarily spend time waiting for a second coming, still, our faith is infused with an ultimate hope. We long to live in the kingdom of God. In the words of the great spiritual, we endeavor to walk in Jerusalem just like John. Progressive Christians are fond of quoting Martin Luther King Jr., who once said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." If you were a seminary student and given to use affected, somewhat esoteric theological language, you might call that King quote an eschatological affirmation. And you might say the same thing about Bill's decision not to hunt. Though it predates Jesus' first coming by several centuries, Christians have used Isaiah's vision of weapons of war being transformed into tools of agriculture in a day when we shall study war no more. Christians have used this as a way of understanding and articulating our ultimate hope. That far end of the moral universe's arc, the second coming of Christ, however it works out, our ultimate hope is that we will, in the great by and by, live in peace. And I've always been of the opinion that it's okay to be impatient about reaching that day when we will all live in peace. We don't have to wait. We can start beating swords into plowshares right now if we want. And of course, we should want. We should work together to live in peace. In August, I preached an anti-war sermon using this passage, and while I stand by everything I said about being against war, I also know that practicing a peaceable Christianity is about more than avoiding war. True nonviolence is not passive. Rather, it is a practice of choosing goodness and wholeness and beauty. It is intentional. Being a peacemaker means creating a climate of peace that's more than just the absence of conflict. And I'm of the opinion that nonviolence requires a good bit of self-awareness. In a recently published essay, the poet Mary Oliver observed that attention is the beginning of devotion. And I agree. In order to be peacemakers, in the fullest sense of the word, we have to be able, like Bill, to pay attention, to recognize when we have become violent, when we have gone, so to speak, from being hunters to being killers. This is something that happens all of the time. For example, there is nothing wrong with patriotism, especially when patriotism inspires us to preserve our nation's watersheds and oceans and air quality, or when patriotism makes us understand the importance of protecting our country's most vulnerable and economically disadvantaged population. Patriotism has the potential to motivate the formation of vibrant communities and a strong and benevolent nation. But when making America great again becomes a jingoistic banality about dropping more bombs on unsuspecting civilians in ancient Middle Eastern cities, when it's about building walls to keep the poor out, or keeping lists so that our misplaced fears deprive our fellow citizens of liberty, then we're beating plowshares into swords. Then we are killers and not hunters. When our desire to have big and powerful automobiles means we turn a blind eye to global warming, when our desire to pay less money for more stuff causes us to ignore the conditions of those who manufacture our unneeded junk in dangerous factories for almost no compensation, then we are walking, or sometimes we're driving a massive unneeded 4x4 in the wrong direction. we're not paying attention. We need to live our lives with awareness. We need to pay attention to how our actions affect the world and its people, who are our sisters and brothers, because like us, they are children of God. And the good news is that such self-awareness is indeed available to us. It is an expression of God's grace that we are able, like my friend Bill, to know when we've stopped being a hunter and have become a killer. We can know when our plowshares are being turned into swords and not the other way around. And we should make that awareness, we should make that knowing our work as people of faith. I suppose that our Thanksgiving table up in Mendocino was like many Thanksgiving tables this year, in that when we weren't telling stories, we were talking about politics. Not as much as I expected. I think we all have a little bit of Trump fatigue. But still, the subject came up, and here's what I think. I think that in the days and weeks and years to come, we will need to pay attention to when we as individuals and when we as communities and as a nation are tempted to change from being hunters to being killers. When the good work of putting food on the table becomes killing for sport or for bloodlust. This may happen because our nation will engage in needless wars. It may happen because our nation's already fragile commitment to civil rights will be compromised even further. It may happen because, as a people, Americans like to own lots of stuff, much of it unneeded, and the election of a billionaire president may inspire in us an even greater desire to own more stuff. And who cares where and how it was made or by what means the cheap stuff came to be in the United States. As a people, Americans may become even less inclined to believe in inconvenient truths about global warming or about the humanity of those living in far-off places. But the simple act of paying attention can be a form of creative resistance. Just knowing ourselves and being aware of when we are hunters and when we are killers can make all the difference. And it can be a gift, not just to ourselves and to those we love, but it can be a gift to the world around us. And maybe someday, when our days on earth are past, those dear to us will sit down to a Thanksgiving meal and will remember the stories about when we chose peace, when we decided to study war no more. And maybe they will be inspired to follow our lead, and the circle will be unbroken, and generations of the faithful will practice awareness as creative resistance. And people of every country will come and say, "Let us go unto the mountain of the Lord," and they will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up war against nation, neither will they study war anymore. This is the longing of Advent. This is the ultimate hope of our faith. This is why we still wait with expectation. Amen.